Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, friends and foes. I hope you're having a good week. Wherever you are, I'm Henrik, and this is Red Ice Radio. This is independent media that offers you a much-needed alternative perspective. In these times where lies and globalist propaganda rule our media, corruption and nepotism rule our banking system, Marxist has won over the culture to their side, and spineless traitors are in charge of our political systems. We need alternative outlets to help to turn the tide. And all these things combined have inversed most people's perception of reality, and people have become pawns in this game, think they're doing the right thing. We do everything we can to fight against the lies and the corruption and help to awaken people to what this fight really is about and what it is that is at stake. You can find out more at redice.tv. Today we're talking about the U.S. military as the enforcer of globalism. Under the guise of nation-building, the American military, under the direction of interests that is hostile to it, has managed to topple leaders in many countries and create havoc that is producing millions of refugees and other people, economic migrants and opportunists that are pouring into Europe, America, Australia, New Zealand for the benefits they offer. Our guest is Samuel Finley. He served as an infantryman in Bosnia and later Afghanistan. He was born and raised in Oklahoma, the U.S. He has written Breakfast with the Dirt Cult. And we're going to talk about his time in the military, what he learned later about global government, and how the U.S. military and those serving is being used in this game. Interesting show. Stay tuned. Samuel Finley, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Henrik. Good to be here.
Excellent. So we've spoken a bit over email. We met very briefly at Ameren earlier this year. You've written a book called Breakfast with a Dirt Cult. It's based on a true story, partially about your time in the military, the deployment in Afghanistan, among other things, your experiences. And I wanted to obviously hear more about that today and talk about what it has been like for you as a veteran to wake up to the realization, if you will, that you've been used as a pawn in the globalist power play of American foreign policy. You know, what they politically correct these days call nation building. It's really nation wrecking. That's what it is. But one of the objectives of our talk here today, beyond just kind of hearing more about what caused you to come over to this side of the fence, if you will, is that we want to try to get closer to both the untapped resource of veterans, but also how to bring many of them kind of to a sensible position when it comes to how they have been used, you know, help to open their eyes. There is a lot of, I think, untapped potential there. Also, a lot of anger, understandably. It's, you know, if some of them were to wake up from what I heard you call the cult of the Constitution and the Oath Keepers mentality, they could become very good assets in the fight, which has turned out to be a fight for our survival, the fight for the soul of the West. So that's really what's going on here. So there's a lot there to chew on, and we'll get to some of that. But let's start at the top and kind of just talk about your book a bit first. Why you wanted to write it, and tell us how close you are to Tom Walton, the main protagonist of the book.
Okay, well, as far as the book goes, Tom Walton is me. I wanted to tell a story of the things I was seeing, but I wanted to do so in the form of a novel, so it'd be funner to read. I'm skeptical of autobiographies or biographies in general, just because people tend to sanitize these things. And I wanted to kind of convey the reality of what I was seeing. So I took notes of everything, and I always tried to remember what people were saying. And I would go through these experiences, and I would think, people need to see these things. I want people to see what I'm seeing and to know these people like I know them, good and bad, just because we get this sort of two-dimensional view of people in the military. I grew up watching MASH, and you'd have these sort of, it's almost kind of Theodore Adorno-esque sort of military people are these evil, uptight, authoritarian fascists. And
I remember
and
MASH. It even ran in Sweden late nights, I remember it.
yeah, and it's always, you know, Hawkeye and his friends, they're always the cool guys. They sort of flout the regulations, and it's always these uptight people. They're the bad guys.
Right.
But then there's the other side, where it's this sort of military people are these almost kind of comic book cartoon sort of characters, where they're real two-dimensional, can-do sort of this hyper-exaggeration of the reality. Everybody's, you know, some SEAL spec ops guy and all that, and the reality's not quite like that. You know, there's good and bad and all that. and I want to try to convey it. So all of the people in there, they're real people. And Tom Walton, he's me, and everything people said, all the dialogue, that's their words, as much as I could remember it.
So tell us a bit more about kind of some of the main stories that you wanted to convey in the book, some of the content of these, and give people who don't know about the book kind of an overview, if you will.
Okay. I enlisted back in 2000. I'd gone through college, and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do when I grew up, but I did want to experience being a soldier, and I thought that would be a good rite of passage. Serve with a bunch of lantern-jawed warriors who'd make a man out of me and all that. And so I enlisted. And I went to basic training in Fort Benning back in 2000, and I immediately hated it. The people with whom I served, it wouldn't surprise me if they're in jail, or at least they should be. I hated the whole thing. Yeah, it was this movable feast of bureaucracy and a bunch of weird sort of wannabe bullies, and it felt like jail, kind of. And over time, it wound up going to this lowest common denominator. And I remember standing in formation one night, and you only get a few hours sleep. And even then, you have to pull fire watch. So you're going to have to get up in the middle of the night for about an hour just to watch the barracks and walk around. And so we're really jealous of over our sleep. And lo and behold, one of the drill sergeants pulled the fire alarm to mess with us. And so we're all standing outside in formation like a bunch of idiots. And it's dark, and we got to get up and 2 or 3 hours to go on some road march or everything. And I'm there with these savages, and I'm thinking, I hate this. Like, I want to tell the whole world about how the military really and truly is. It wasn't supposed to be this way. You know, Bill Murray lied to us. But then I wound up getting out of basic and going through airborne school and then getting stuck in a really good platoon. And it took us a while to kind of warm up, but being surrounded by them was one of the highlights of my life. They were a good bunch of guys and doing a really weird job at times and navigating this sort of hyper-managerialism and this sort of kind of frat boy sort of environment. But being able to do so, we wound up kind of building a kind of tribe. It was really gratifying, and there's nothing I've really had in the civilian world that measured up quite that way since then.
Yeah, interesting. You know, after the Second World War, I think some of the best movies that were ever made, if you discount the propaganda in them, of course, has been war movies. I have to say that the feeling, even some of the British movies that were made, were just, I mean, wonderful, beautiful movies about this camaraderie and if there's some essence, a sense of this of I think something that's lacking in our modern world today that they managed to kind of convey then. And I think it was to kind of continue and have a very favorable view of the military. And I think, you know, this translated over into later movies, as you say, with Bill Murray. I was enlisted. What was that called? I forget one of the ones he was in.
I'm thinking of Stripes.
Stripe, exactly. That's one of them. Yeah, exactly. That kind of feeling and everything else. So it was, at least initially then in the beginning, it was far, far from that, right?
Oh yeah, I hated the whole thing. One of my buddies, he told me later, whenever he saw me at the dining facility, said he saw me for the first time sitting there alone, and he said I had this look on my face that just told everybody I really didn't want to be there. And that's kind of how I felt.
Give us an idea of what your time in Afghanistan was like, and how, you know, the experiences you had there, all the things that you were taught, you know, about the enemy and all these kinds of things, and later how that kind of juxtaposed to what you have learned more recently of how the military in the U.S. really is being used. I could just imagine that kind of awakening must be difficult to a certain extent of realizing that you've kind of been used by the globalists, right, in this way and just taken advantage of.
The way we looked at it, we were going to go neutralize Taliban al-Qaeda assets. You know, we no personal grievance against any of the locals. You know, they're having to deal with a hostile insurgency, and so we were going there with the mentality of confronting a threat. And so we, again, the unit I served with were a really great bunch of guys, and they really tried to be honorable and do the right thing. And there was a delicate sort of balance there where you're dealing with people who aren't wearing uniforms. You know, they're wearing flip-flops and, you know, wearing a headscarf, and you know, they look like everybody else. And you're going into a village, you don't know who's an enemy and who isn't. I mean, on the other hand, you want to try to treat people with dignity. You don't want to go roughing people up or abusing people or that sort of thing. But on the other hand, you do kind of have to go around with this constant knowledge that one of them could try to kill you at any moment. So that sort of became just sort of our kind of default mentality of being there.
Obviously, there is a real threat, you know, in terms of, you know, however you view the origins of Al-Qaeda and who's funded them. We you know, we don't have to get into this moment, but we see a similar thing in Syria, for example, where, of course, you know, the U.S. and other countries, NATO, are they're supplying, you know, arms to these what they call moderate rebels and these kinds of things to, you know, to fight ISIS and all this stuff. But despite that, the true motives of why America is there fighting the war, was that something that you guys ever discussed or thought about or were, you know, kind of briefed on? Or how does that look from the inside?
Well, no, it was just these were terrorists. And they were headquartered out of here, under, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, the standard narrative. This is where they were headquartered, and we needed to go find them, close with them, and destroy them. And that was pretty much it. But it was an odd thing in that, seeing how that evolved. I remember the first deployment I went on was Bosnia, and we had half of our company in the air when September 11th happened, and we weren't quite sure what to make of anything. We weren't sure who was behind this, what was going to happen. And we wound up going there, and it becomes more and more apparent that, okay, this is radical Islam, and we're going to have to confront them at some point. And we even went on raids sometimes in Bosnia, just a few, but there were Mujahideen who had settled in the area during the Yugoslavian war. And there was threat. There was many who were thinking that they were going to be activated and we were going to have to confront them. But later on, things began to harden up, and it was believed that this was Al-Qaeda under Osama bin Laden, and this was going to be our enemy from here on out. And so that was kind of the mentality going into it and then throughout the campaign there.
Do you feel that the military presence is justified in the region? Do you guys need to be there to kind of maintain the peace? What's your view on that today?
Oh, as for that, I don't know. I'm of the school of thought that the less the better, and more often more harm than good comes from these interventions. I was happier to go to the Afghanistan campaign than the Iraq one, because I had mixed feelings about the build up to that one, because there was, and rightfully so, a great deal of controversy surrounding that. And whereas Afghanistan seemed a little bit cleaner in terms of purpose and objective.
Yeah, because it had, you know, you had some ties to Al-Qaeda there, which was largely, you know, U.S. founded when they're starting to fight Russia on the border in the north of Afghanistan, right? Iraq had seemingly nothing to do with 9/11. There was no link, no connection there.
Right. It was really kind of mind blowing to a lot of us, of wondering, you know, what in the world connection is this? But as far as Afghanistan goes, what you were talking about our presence there, I think this nation building mentality is a complete and total mistake. They're a different culture, and they have a different way of looking at things, and that's trying to impose your will on them. That's inevitably you're going to want to dominate them and make them in your image, and there's no way around that. The trouble is in the West, we don't want to do that at all, so we want to kind of go about it in kind of a passive-aggressive sort of way, make them want to do what we want them to do, while making it seem like it's their idea, and you're not really fooling them.
Let me ask you a bit more about when you started to kind of wake up and go in a different direction, and because I want to hear more about how you when that occurred, and if that was after you, when you've gotten home, or if it happened when you were still in the military. Tell us about that process for you, and what woke you up to a different kind of idea of what the military does, and what their purpose is, and what really is happening.
Sure, it was in part a continual process, and you get sent on these missions, and in some ways they don't make any sense, and you begin to wonder, who are the people behind this? This is dumb, you're going to go do what we call a VCP, or vehicle checkpoint. And in this case, it would be the second biggest highway in Afghanistan. It was out of Kandahar. And you'd have these huge lanes of highway, and you'd stop traffic, and you'd immediately notice that people would break out of queue, and they would try to pass around, and you'd stop them. And then they would try to drive on the sidewalk, and you'd see these lines going across the sidewalk, and you'd think, this is crazy. You're wondering, what in the world is this about? You've got these whole rules and protocols that you follow that are completely incompatible with these other people. This makes no sense. And your mind, you do that enough, you know, throughout every mission or that comes down, and just over months, you begin to become really critical of policies and procedures, and you see kind of holes in strategies and whatnot. You sort of follow that rabbit where it leads. Of course, you're also deployed, and you have to worry about your people. You have to worry about the mission and carrying out your duties. It was later being in the hospital where I had time to think and I had time to finally catch up on the news and read things that I began to really start asking questions, especially being in a military hospital. You're seeing people mangled up in all sorts of ways that I wouldn't have imagined previously. And I began to become really critical of the narrative that was being pushed, because at the time it was 2004, and this was an election year, and the left had really gone hard into that whole, not just anti-war, or anti-Republican for that matter, but they were really focusing on red staters and Christians, and they're trying to bring about some theocracy and force it upon the world, and this is, you know, these evil people. In fact, I remember one time coming across this article that was, I think it was taken from the Seattle Stranger about the urban archipelago theory. And the idea was that most Democratic supporters are in cities. Therefore, the Democratic Party should quit trying to play to rural or these red state type people, and instead just focusing on cities and do whatever they can to marginalize them, basically. Now, I had three gunshot wounds from an Al-Qaeda operative at the time, and I'm feeling incredibly betrayed. Yeah. Nobody where I'm from is really interested in these international crusades for globalism and all these sorts of things. I mean, we like to go, you know, I believe the special forces have a motto, you know, to free the oppressed. I mean, these are the sort of messages that appeal to us. We're not interested in, you know, filling the streets with the blood of the non-believers or anything like that. And you're thinking, these people don't know what they're talking about. The churches I grew up in, they would gather money and send missionaries to try to help people and build them infrastructure and all that. They weren't really interested in killing strangers for the sake of killing strangers. And the narrative I was getting completely conflicted with the reality I'd lived. And that, from there on out, it was sort of off to the races of, I know these people are lying to me. And why are they? What's this really about?
You know, the military's changed a lot over the years too. It's definitely turned into more of a kind of in some respects, a social justice warrior, you know, outreach arm. I remember just last year of some of these poor army forces, the cadets, I think, was forced to wear high heels, right, to help to promote feminism, stuff like that. There's things that have changed along the way, and it's a very different kind of, you know, military, even just, you know, 10 years ago. You know, however, one thing that they've always have been involved in, though, is obviously to bring, you know, a different kind of political system, a different structure to all these other countries. You know, this has been done under the neocon arm, of course, of bringing democracy to the rest of the world, which makes, you know, this ideology even line up more with some kind of Trotskyism than he does with some, you know, some crazy, kooky American right-wing ideology, right?
Oh, yeah.
When did you begin to realize that? When did you begin to kind of wake up to the military being an arm for, like, a different agenda? What kind of material did you come across first?
That was a little bit longer in the going, in part because you develop this sort of resistance to these sorts of criticisms, because you hear similar things from the left all the time, you know, that the military are these evil arms for, you know, oil companies or, you know, all that sort of thing. Whereas you know your people, you know your soldiers to the left and right of you, and you know some of the good that you do downrange, and you think, you know, I know these people are working an angle. I know what we're doing, and there are people who are smarter than us, and so I'm going to trust in that in this mission. it wasn't until later, beginning to look into, I got my master's in international studies following, following my time in the service, and reading some of their theories, completely kind of threw me for a loop. For instance, you'd have people like Michael Ignatieff, who I believe he's involved with the Liberal Party up in Canada. He was very hawkish on the war. He teaches at Harvard, I believe, and I think he was also involved with Oxford. And this was a leftist who was openly for the war. The war happens, and the quagmire ensues, and then he begins walking it back. That while he was entertaining these notions of human rights and their universality, and you need a universal enforcement mechanism like the U.S. military, in reality, it doesn't work that way. And you begin to see that amongst the intelligentsia, there are these notions of globalism as an ideology, and that you have this free flow, unlike anything seen before, of goods, labor, capital, ideas, and as it follows that there must be some sort of global consciousness, and we need to be able to manage these conflicts at a global level. And the U.S. is supposed to be the agent of that, which means the military. And you begin to see that both this left and this right, when you get above a certain level, there's this general consensus of how the world should work, and that the military is supposed to underwrite that. And reading these people in their own words, like Henry Kissinger, who once said that military men are dumb brutes for foreign policy. That it's tough to have served in a war and have worn a flag on your shoulder and hear those things and not just be triggered to the moon. So that was kind of when it started, just reading their own words.
Yeah.
Like there was I mentioned in our conversation, Kaplan, Robert Kaplan, who's a neocon. I'd like to read that for some of the viewers who might not have heard of him. There's this guy, Robert Kaplan, who wrote a book called Warrior Politics, Why Leadership Demands a Pagan Ethos. And this isn't, as far as I'm concerned, this is demeaning to both pagans and Christians. So Kaplan writes, for American power to endure, it will need to be impelled by a more primitive level of altruism than that of the universal society it seeks to encourage. American patriotism, honoring the flag, 4th of July celebrations, and so on, must survive long enough to provide the military armature for an emerging global civilization that may eventually make such patriotism obsolete. Now,
very interesting.
He's a run-of-the-mill neocon. And he's went to the right schools. He has all the right friends. And there's nothing controversial in what he says amongst those sorts of people. And whether they're like Michael Ignatieff to the left, or whether they're the Henry Kissingers, or anywhere in between. This is the consensus that's supposed to happen, and the United States military is ultimately supposed to bleed and underwrite that. And that's a farce, Henrik. that's completely under false pretenses. I mean, you have people who genuinely believe in what they do in their country. They identify with it, its history, and its people, and it's bad enough to have that mentality and grow up in a culture that completely despises those things.
Yeah. It's useful patriotism for them, right? Because the left has taken over the political system, in many countries. But if we just talk about the U.S. right now, the Obama-Hillary kind of progressivism that we've seen in the last 8 years have been so successful that they've taken the whole apparatus and the whole machine, turned it in their favor. So where they previously were attacking America, they were they wanted almost stomp on the flag and screw all this neo-colonialism kind of attitude that the U.S. has. Now it's become an arm of it. So they can no longer start attacking those things, because that would be like attacking themselves, right? So and there's two parts to this. One is they have, to a certain extent, already done enough damage for people who, don't kind of like what America represents or whatever. So many people on the left are still very anti-American, but the top layers of the political guard, like Obama, they managed to take something like the Constitution, for example, and it kind of turned it into this document for social justice and civil rights and these kinds of issues, of saying, pointing to the quality of the document and all these kinds of things. So it's a very, very sly twisting, I would say, of the message, and it's been very successful to a certain extent, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the more insidious things about this, and that I think is in many ways happened with the greater culture. And there's this retcon that happens in the post-World War II era where the United States and what it means, it's not to be, for ourselves and our posterity or a reflecting of a particular civilization or anything like that. It's supposed to be this global society. And then, taking it a step further, it's supposed to visit these things upon the world. And one of the legitimizing factors in that is to be the Constitution. It's like this holy writ, which in reality is just supposed to articulate a process of government. But even then, the people who wrote it, in Washington's own, one of his drafts for his inaugural address, even makes a reference that no mound of parchment is going to be able to stop the inherent greed of people. You're going to have to deal with human corruption at some point, and this no document is going to be sovereign against that. But it gets endowed with this sort of almost supernatural meaning, which is unfortunate because you go through these experiences. You go down range. You get in firefights. You lose parts of yourself. You lose friends, and you wonder what all that means. And that meaning gets sublimated into things like the Constitution. And so it's one of those things that we to utter that, to bring that up immediately will trigger emotions in people who've served and who've sworn oath to defend it. The trouble is, it's the people on the other side of that oath, they know that. And they're like, as Kaplan talks about, or Kissinger, or Carol Quigley. They know these things. And they're more than happy to manipulate your particular loves and loyalties for these universalist ends, which more often than not are nothing more than smokescreens for others who are just really ambitious and greedy.
So America is, it's the police, it's the enforcer of this, new emerging globalist kind of structure that we have. And eventually I think it will maybe not be turned against itself, but it will probably be, in their vision, reformed in some way. It will turn into some kind of more universal, global kind of institution. But for now, It serves a very good agenda, that's what you're saying, by remaining what it is and kind of using, really, a lot of these people are still very patriotic, very pro-American, to take their true sentiments and feelings and kind of derail those and put them in a different direction without, of course, really telling them about any of these things.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've been doing a little bit of reviewing on the war in Yugoslavia. I spent 6 months there. We deployed there. We served in the peacekeeping mission. The way it was taught to us was the way it was sort of told to everybody that, there was this, there's a great deal of instability in the region, following the death of Tito, Slobodan Milosevic stoked resentments among Serbs, and there was this hyper-nationalism, and we had to stop it. It came to my attention recently that much of that stuff was a farce.
Absolutely.
And like there's that iconic picture of the guy behind the fence. It's reminiscent of the Holocaust.
Yep, that's right.
And come to find out, that was actually it didn't happen the way that the media portrayed that. There was a German journalist who went in to investigate this, and come to find out, this was a refugee center. A bunch of Bosnian Muslims had started going there, and they erected this sort of ad hoc refugee center. They were trying to escape Serbian militia as well as Bosnian factions, Bosnian Muslim factions, who were trying to press gang, various Muslims into fighting for them. And so they were trying to get away from everybody. And so they went to this refugee center. And oddly enough, there were even Serbian forces who were pulling security for them. And these refugees could come and go as they please. And the Serbian forces were permitting them to. Meanwhile, you had international press. They were trying to gin up this conflict, and they were using heresies and rumors and cattle cars and all this sort of thing.
Right.
And so these Brits, they send in this media team, and apparently next door to this refugee center, there was this compound, and it was fenced with this old beat up wire. And they set up shop there. They set up their cameras, and they started filming this refugee center. And they were shooting this through the fence, and they went and they talked to the Serbian forces. They talked to the refugees. They had free run of the place. and they get back, they go to Britain. They send off their footage and whatnot. And then, lo and behold, there's one frame that gets taken out of that. And it's the guy behind the fence, and it's completely framing this as a concentration camp. And immediately, that's the money shot. Like, they've got their war right now. And John Major, who I believe he was the Prime Minister of England at the time, he calls an emergency meeting. We got to get British boots on the ground. Clinton, who was running for president, was telling George Bush, we need to do something about these people. And it was a complete fabrication. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. When you get to really chasing down the Yugoslavian war, there's all sorts of craziness.
Yep.
I spent 6 months there, and I could tell you about the refugees I saw. I could tell you about the orphans I got to talk to. I could talk to you about the landmines that we tried to avoid. There are 3 million there in the country, and landmines move depending on what type of soil and weather you're getting. So I could tell you about those things, but I couldn't tell you with a high degree of confidence just what in the world that war was about. However, you can find the usual suspects at play. I mean, you can find these international movements like communism, which sought to impose its will and engineer this new society by repressing national, ethnic, religious identities. It's violently so. I mean, they were executing people. You can also find people like our friend George Soros in conjunction with various intelligence networks trying to drum up propaganda. You can find the IMF trying to exert influence over then Yugoslavia's central bank. They did this sort of textbook Washington Consensus neoliberal sort of dogma of lowering down the depreciating the currency, freezing wages, and all these various policies that basically run a country through kind of a chopping block. And all this chaos ensues, and then afterwards, in comes the World Bank and the IMF, and then you're going to wind up in places like Kosovo that I was reading about, where apparently they were really rich in things like in minerals and in coal deposits, and those things got auctioned off at basement prices, and you wind up with U.S. soldiers pulling security over what amounts to George Soros' latest acquisition.
Yeah.
And you think of the guys who are pulling security. I mean, this is probably some 18-year-old from Omaha, Nebraska, who, he loves his country and its history and its people, and he's probably had grandparents who fought in the world wars, and he's wanting to kind of step up and fill the shoes in that legacy and
make his daddy proud, right?
Yeah, and that's probably a good guy, and he's
sure.
What he's doing on his level is honorable, and he's serving his country. But there's this whole other level when if you peek behind the oath, if you peek towards the people who engineer the policies that filter down into orders for military people, those people they're not acting in good faith. They're working angles. Some for crazy utopian schemes, and others for just downright greed and malice. And that's a complete and total betrayal of good people who are trying to do the right thing. And that has to be addressed.
Yeah, that's why it's so important, to try to wake many of these people up. And, I mean, preferably before they go into military, before they get to a point where they have volunteered, where they might have, limbs blown off or worse, some people lose their lives, obviously many do. But just this idea of like trying to have some sensibility come back into the picture of trying to awaken those people. But that's an incredible difficult thing to do, isn't it? We spoke about this when we, talked last time about how to reach those people, how basically to have them find the kind of material that you're talking about and examples like your book of teaching them, these kinds of things. That's very difficult because they're in a very kind of insular environment of very, a managed message that comes out from the, from the media and it's very, very difficult. I don't know how to reach them. But this, one of the reasons why this is important, I feel too, is because of what might happen in Europe. I've framed this in a number of shows, but I see the Balkans, Bosnia, Serbia, and Kosovo, everything that happens there as a kind of a mini version of what potentially might happen on a larger scale in Europe when and if either a single European country or multiple European countries maybe is finally starting to kind of push back against the migrant invasion that's happening right now. I think, Sam, you would have an American military there backed up by NATO forces, United Nations forces, what have you, very, very quickly, right? And literally turn on the host native population of that country. So I see this as a huge problem and a big potential disaster in the future. What's your view on this?
I think there's a measure of potential there for that. To what degree, I'm not quite sure. I think with a lot of these people, they would try to be kind of more circumspect, kind of under the radar of using more, you know, special operations community or, you know, various intelligence assets to try to nip this thing off small and try to keep it as under the radar as possible. Because as you were saying, I mean, once you start putting full U.S. forces, NATO conventional boots on the ground, like that's already incredibly controversial. And you're going to have a great many Americans who are going to look at that conflict. They're pointing weapons at Europeans as opposed to these recent, the refugees. That says something. And that leads to a chaos I think most people don't want to see. What do you think as far as Swedish military, or have you heard anything from their point of view, or?
Not really. I mean, not at this stage anyway, but I was thinking about things like, what if the American military slowly is diversified, is basically filled with people who are no longer, maybe have that kind of allegiance to America as the current military does, right? You've had, for example, financial incentives within the military. I know a lot of people that, for some, it's the only avenue of getting some money, of making some money, or paying off their student loans, you know, these kinds of things. There's deals there, so there's kind of almost like a mercenary quality to it. I don't think we're going to see a draft return back to America soon, but my point is if the military goes through the same demographic change that we've seen the rest of America go through, then I think it would be more likely that something like that could actually occur. What do you think?
That I don't know. I like to think that's still a ways off. The military is a for all of the sort of social justice sort of tinkering, the combat arms themselves are still a fairly conservative branch, just by nature of the beast. I mean, it revolves around fundamentals and discipline that ultimately you have to be able to conduct a war. And so I like to think that at least for a while, it's going to reject the pause as much as possible. Hopefully until we can get some sort of better leadership, but that's going to take some doing.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's a heavy, is an uphill battle, it feels like.
Certainly. Was it something like everybody above the rank of colonel pretty much is a political appointee. And those people, they're selected for certain traits. For instance, General Petraeus, I was reading something where he was giving a speech on, I believe it was after America, where he was talking about prospective strategies for an America in which eventually the U.S. gets absorbed into this North American Union, and you know how we need to sort of work towards that and the implications and so forth. This is a guy who was in charge of the CIA. He was a high-ranking general in the Army, and he swore an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic, that articulates power as defined for a sovereign country, and yet here he is as a spokesman for ultimately the destruction of that sovereignty in favor of this, you know, this union, this supranational union. What do you call that? Like that? How is that anything other than a betrayal?
It is.
And he's the guy in charge. that's this problem we have. What do you do when it's, what's the title that Christopher Lash used, the revolt of the elites? What happens when your elites revolt?
Right.
And they're ultimately globalists while you're kind of a nationalist.
And that's what's happening right now. You know?
Yeah.
They have an agreement. They have an idea of what the world should be turned into possibly, in their view, to make it a better place. I don't think many of them, I mean, I know that there's a few of these very high rollers and big players, of course, that do wake up in the morning and says, haha, I'm going to subvert, more people today or something. But most people don't, you know, when they wake up and have breakfast, it's like, I'm going to try to make the world a better place today, right? And as I say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and I think that's where we are. The other thing that happened, feel free to comment on that too. I don't want to derail where we're going here, but I know that you know, Obama has been like continuing his military purge. There's tons of generals that have been outed out of the military. It feels like it's been going through a reform of its own, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know much about that in terms of, you know, what the upper kind of what the brass, you know, are up to, and if many of those old generals are being kind of outed for other people that have maybe that have a more favorable allegiance to this global, you know, emerging global governance system that you're talking about.
I can't speak in depth on that, but I just from people like General Mattis and so forth, there seems to have been this, as you say, a purge. And for anyone who kind of breaks ranks from this sort of kind of globalist paradigm, but in some ways, I think it's almost institutionalized by this point, because all these people go through war colleges. Many of them go through places like Harvard, and they study international affairs, and this is they get this consensus. And it's tough to get rid of that once these ideas have taken hold so far. It's not to say it's impossible, but it is difficult when that's your guiding star.
Listen to this. This is from redflagnews.com. We are in the gravest situations. Our military, once the most powerful in the world, is crumbling. Obama is purging every branch of the U.S. armed forces at an alarming rate. He's deliberately crippling our military, setting them up for failure and defeat. Through his actions, he's rapidly demoralizing our troops en masse, creating a dangerous situation at home and abroad, leaving our troops, our country, and we as citizens open to attack. Retired Army Major General Patrick Brady, recipient of the U.S. military's highest decoration of the Medal of Honor, as well as other top-tier officials, say Obama's agenda is decimating the morale of the U.S. ranks to the point members no longer feel prepared to fight or have the desire to win. And it says, since Obama took office, an unprecedented number of top military leaders have been removed from their posts. Nearly 200 generals, flag officers, and other high-ranking officials, they are being removed at a rate of about one per week. This is from late last year, but that's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In some ways, though, I think he's just more like the culmination of this consensus. You know, with his election, for instance, we know about Journolist and how it almost like pro wrestling. They decided to call the match. This was going to be their candidate, reflective of their values and their worldview. And who taught them? Where did they go to school? Who pays their checks? And it's this institutional consensus of, we're going to make the world better, and we're going to use the U.S. to do it, and we're going to make, you know, we're going to use the military because they have to take the orders. This isn't like the civilian populace where we can just kind of over time slowly, you know, using the law and the media to kind of engineer them the way we want to. We can simply have a general give an order, and if he won't, we'll fire him and we'll get someone who will. And that to me is the thing I would like to see. I would like to see some fight get sent to that part. What was it? Bernays was talking about like the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the habits and the opinions of the masses is critical to modern democracy, or something to that effect.
Yeah, Edward Bernays. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud.
Yeah,
greatest psychologist of our time.
Yes, that to me is because ultimately the civilian branch they oversee the military. These generals, they get their orders from civilians. And in many respects, that's good. But in other ways, you wind up with people calling these shots who really don't know what they're talking about. You know, like with Madeleine Albright talking about, you know, what's good of having this military if you don't use it? What does she know?
Yeah.
She's just some bloodthirsty warmonger who doesn't really give a damn one way or the other. She just has some angle she wants to push, and it doesn't really matter what the butcher's bill looks like, let alone who pays it. Meanwhile, these are real people, and they place their trust in their leaders that whatever sacrifices they make are going to be for, you know, for them and theirs, for their country and whatnot. And they're more often than not, they're not. It's these people, like you were talking about, who have this worldview that, you know, we can, once we're liberated from all of our pesky pre-modern mores and norms and false consciousnesses, we can be integrated into this end of history last man, and we'll have no more conflict, and that'll be great. And that's a lie. Anybody with a lick of sense knows that. But ultimately, these are the people who shape the consensus, and they're the ones who call the shots. which is unfortunate. But I like to think that's changing. I mean, you can only do that for so long. And you see a bunch of guys running around in high heel shoes, you know, military uniforms. If you're a young man who's thinking about, you know, maybe a career in the service, you're going to want to rethink that.
Well, here is Madeleine Albright. I think you've heard this before.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Yeah. So that was regarding 500,000 Iraqi children dead, and that was Madeleine Albright. Yep, it's worth it because they have a bigger fish to fry. They have a different idea of you know, they're willing to sacrifice on the altar of globalism anything that stands in its way, including you know, innocent young children.
Yeah, and in the end, what happens with their parents, you know, or their families who survive? I mean, you've seen your village just get decimated. What happens? You know, you're going to be very angry about that, and you're going to want to redress that.
Absolutely.
Or you see, or even if it, not in terms of just hard power, of soft power. I mean, you know, you have NGOs, you have these foundations, you have, you know, the media who see this as a way of exerting influence over other people. And what shape does that take? I mean, it's this sort of degenerate pause that we suffer from here in the States, and we export it abroad. How are we doing anything other than provoking people sometimes?
Well, that's just it, though, and yet they criticize someone like Trump for actually wanting to start vetting some of these people coming in a different capacity. It's not enough to, when you have naturalization of you know, people wanting to come to the U.S. and become U.S. citizens, of asking them, you know, what's your intentions or you know, what's your allegiances or whatever. It's kind of like on the airplane, right? In the good old days, they put you a note when you're going to travel into the U.S. that says, do you have a plan to assassinate the president of the United States? You know, you have like the checkbox options there, you know. It's kind of on par with that, right? So what Trump proposes is, you know, we're at war with these people. We're over there in their region. We're screwing around. Why can't we do anything back home, right? Why can't we make sure that our civilians in our own country internally are not going to be bombed by people who, you know, may be understandable for some of them, their sentiments want to damage and hurt America and as many Americans as possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it boggles the mind that that's somehow controversial. I mean, we did that with communists.
And national socialists in Germany, you know, a bunch of stuff like that. Yeah,
it's perfectly sensible. If you're in a conflict with, you know, foreign nationals or something, you want to minimize your exposure to your own people. And that may be inconvenient for some, but that's in the long term, that's wise. But yeah, it's bizarre that that's somehow that bothers people, but apparently it does.
Yeah, it's like the attitude they've adopted now when it comes to radical Islam and jihadism or whatever is basically, we can't, you know, kind of do anything about it or I mean, that's not really happening, but in the you know, Obama's kind of worldview, it's like we can't single them out because that will make them angry, right? And then you will create terrorism, so you can't do that. So you just have to back up and back up and back up and basically give all these people what they want, because otherwise they will turn into terrorists. And then it's not their fault, it's actually our fault, right? So it's this incredible double standard of being involved in this so-called nation building with these ruthless wars, tremendous problems that's created in these countries. And there they can drop how many bombs they want, but back in on American soil, people aren't allowed to defend themselves or even be suspicious, right? I find that so contradictory, and it's like a double think, whatever you want to call it, right? That somehow, you know, all these Al-Qaeda people and Muslims were responsible for 9/11 and all these bombings and shootings and everything else, but you can't be Islamophobic. You can't have any sentiments against this group, right? Despite the fact that they officially tell you that this group is the group we're fighting. It's kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah, well, what was it? Jonathan Bowden had made the comment that liberalism is moral syphilis. And you can kind of see that at work. You know, under this mentality of liberalism, you can't really have distinctions. We all have to be individuals, and we're all going to be equal. And any sort of making these lines between, you know, different types of people, you know, or different beliefs or whatever, that shouldn't factor into the equation because we're all the same. But it really doesn't work that way. You at some point become unable to engage in any measure of threat assessment. And if you have people like, for instance, you know, ISIS or Al Qaeda or whatever, who they've openly said, you know, we're coming after you, or we're going to do this or that, it would behoove you to at least on some level take them seriously, and to keep an eye on them at the very least. Maybe not let a bunch of them in. There was a gentleman I was reading. I believe he writes under the blog title of Weapons Man. He's a retired SF soldier, I believe, and he was even saying amongst, you know, a lot of like the special ops community, it's generally as a given, one out of every 10 refugees is going to have some sort of insurgent affiliation. And that's just kind of a rule of thumb. That's a big number whenever you're dealing in millions.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially in the sort of kind of cultural climate we have, where it's sort of all against all. It's easy to go in there and sort of figure out where the fault lines are and start looking for weaknesses. For instance, there was a gentleman, I believe it was Scott Coughlin, who on YouTube, he posted a series of what he calls the Red Pill Briefings on radical Islam and its attempts at subversion, particularly through leftism. And what the gentleman with the Muslim Brotherhood, he had made the connection that if we use a word like Islamophobia, we can get the left to immediately cover for half of the stuff we do. It just is sort of like a propaganda rhetorical gimmick. And it'll immediately shut down any sort of opposition. I mean, you can even see this with, you know, these sort of the conservatives, you know, like, well, that's Islamophobic, and they'll immediately have to start backtracking these things.
That's right.
It's like, well, no, I mean, this is a different belief system. It's a different worldview. It comes from a different people, a different part of the world, these things are inevitably going to lead to some form of conflict, and there's nothing crazy about trying to conduct some sort of risk analysis like a grown-up and think, well, maybe we want to limit our exposure to this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. You know, later we can get into as well what actually drives the, beyond just globalism, of a lot of people that are standing behind the attitudes that you know, comes out of this environment that we're talking about. You know, we can ask the question, Is it the culture? Is it politics? Is it media? Is it Hollywood movies ultimately that, you know, it inspires people to morally, you know, go in a certain direction because they feel it's the right thing to do? You know, and these things, despite that they're cultural, are becoming large underpinnings of politics, economics, and all these kinds of things. And we're seeing the world, you know, kind of changing because of that. But, Sam, one thing I want to do is in a little bit here, just, take a break and then pick up in the second segment. There's a lot more to talk about. I know you have many aspects. We, you know, as I said, we've spoken before on many things that are good, if you will, that I want to get to and get our audiences a chance to hear out as well. But let's just talk a bit more about the book and where people can get copies of it. I don't think you have a website set up for it or anything like that, or some Facebook or Twitter account or something. Is Amazon the best place to go to pick up copies?
Yes, Henrik. You can find it on Amazon at Breakfast with the Dirt Cult. It's available in paperback and Kindle.
And there's a couple of reviews out there. We'll link to those. You have one on Tacky Mag. You have one on Countercurrents. I don't know. Maybe there's more out there too. But there's some good reviews there for maybe a more comprehensive overview than we've done so far here on this program. But it's called Breakfast with the Dirt Cult. It's both Kindle and paperback. And if you want to read more, definitely. Take a look. We'll add links to the Amazon page as well. Anything else they should know about the book before we take a short break here, Sam?
No, I think that's good.
All right, very good. Well, stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with more of Samuel Finley. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Stay put for the second hour with Samuel Finley. We'll continue as we do at redicemembers.com. Go there and sign up for membership with us and continue to listen to this show and all our previous shows. You get full access to our members' archives. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you on the other side.